I'm very happy now to welcome Steve Michael. He's an attorney with the Western Resource Advocates, and he will be testifying next week before the New Mexico Environmental Improvement Board on the subject of carbon caps here in New Mexico. And Bruce Frederick is with us. He is an attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk about these regulations in some specificity. What actually are the regulations that are being proposed in front of the New Mexico Environmental Improvement Board?
Well, essentially the regulations would look at two sectors of New Mexico's economy, electric utilities and oil and gas operations. Those two sectors in New Mexico emit the overwhelming majority of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, into the atmosphere. And so these regulations would instruct that those sectors reduce their greenhouse gas emissions in a manner that's consistent with what scientists are telling us needs to be done to avoid the most significant impacts of climate change.
And so what do the rules actually say? How much reduction do we need to do next year, the year after, and so on?
What the rules do is they set a baseline of 2010, and they tell electric utilities, oil and gas operators, that they must reduce 3% per year their greenhouse gas emissions. And these emissions have all been reported to NMED, the Environment Department, that they must reduce their emissions 3% per year from their 2010 levels. The regulation then calls for the Environment Department and the Environmental Improvement Board in 2014 to look at these regulations, see how they are comporting with what science is telling us needs to be done, see whether we're achieving those kinds of reduction results, and to the extent the regulations need to be modified to get them consistent with what science is saying, then they would be modified in 2014.
How are they actually supposed to achieve these 3% reductions per year?
They, and this is Bruce Frederick, they can achieve them either through reductions at the source or through offsetting, either offsets that in other operations they own that aren't covered or through offsets from other companies, other sources.
And so, for example, let's say that I am PNM and I've got this big, huge, gigantic coal plant, and New Mexico is in a state of economic growth and demanding ever more energy. What would be some ways, and is there assistance to these utilities, for example, to come up with ways to achieve that 3% reduction every year? In other words, are there some giant inefficiencies that are kind of low-hanging fruit that they can do immediately, and then what?
There are improvements to the efficiency of the operation of those plants that the utilities can do. How much they've done already remains to be seen. But by improving the efficiency of how they operate, improving the how much energy you get, how much electricity you get for a given fuel input, you can reduce your carbon dioxide emissions that way. Some of the more promising aspects, though, are things like energy efficiency for their customers. If their customers conserve electricity, the utilities can produce less. The less they produce, the less greenhouse gases they emit. Another option is obviously renewable energy. They can install solar generators, wind generators to augment the power that's coming out of their coal and gas plant. To the extent those renewable generators run, they can back down their fossil generators and reduce their greenhouse gases that way.
So if you and I reduce our energy by spending our own money to buy Energy Star appliances and turning out our lights and all of that stuff, they get to claim it as a reduction?
If it's reducing their output, then it would help them in their compliance. Now, keep in mind, though, that the utilities do have energy efficiency programs to provide assistance to customers to be more efficient so that at the end of the day, the customers do receive some, I don't know if subsidy is the word, they receive some assistance in deploying their own energy efficiency measures.
Help me out and help our listeners out with this. Utilities burn fossil fuels in order to create electricity. But what about oil and gas industries? They produce it, but the rest of us burn it. So how does that work? I mean, are we talking about the extraction and refining industries that are also burning so much fuel that they qualify under these regulations?
Yeah, we're actually, in response to some criticism or some ambiguities in our proposed rule, we're actually going to recommend some changes, and we will be regulating under our proposal combustion sources like refineries and things like that, treatment plants, processing plants, but not upstream sources like production wells and gathering systems. And what that means is there's a lot of methane and carbon dioxide leaks in the upstream system that can be contained through reasonable economic measures. And if they do that, the companies can use those to offset their emissions at their downstream sources. They could also that should also create a market for those offsets that they can sell to third parties.
Yeah, to get to your question, too, you're exactly right. What we're regulating here are the emissions from the production of oil and gas, the production, processing, refining. We're not regulating the combustion of those gases of themselves, the natural gas that you get in your homes, the oil, the gasoline that you use in your cars. Those are dealt with through other mechanisms, for example, the clean car standards at the federal level.
So, and I think what's important for people to understand is that on a federal level, transportation is being dealt with a lot more than utilities.
Utilities aren't being dealt with at all as far as greenhouse gases go.
When we talk about oil and gas industries, they are, in New Mexico or I suppose anywhere, to some extent decentralized. So how are you regulating this? In other words, is it by company? Is it by production location or what?
It's going to be by a source. And you know, the oil and gas companies in the testimony they filed complained that it looked like we wanted to aggregate a lot of dispersed sources. Like there are something like 50,000 oil and gas wells out there in New Mexico, and they thought we wanted to aggregate all those and treat those as single sources. And our rule isn't going to do that. We're going to regulate individual sources like refineries, like treatment facilities and processing facilities that are discrete places.
So we're talking about regulations that have never existed before in the state of New Mexico or really much of anywhere, regulating big industries that probably don't want to be regulated. Who enforces this? Let's say that these regulations are adopted by the state of New Mexico. Who enforces them and how?
The Environment Department would enforce those regulations. The Environmental Improvement Board is considering the regulations. If the board adopts the regulations, then the Environment Department would be responsible for implementing and enforcing them. If there are appeals under those regulations, appeals would go to the board and then to a court.
Just sort of out of curiosity, would there be any positive effects of these regulations on pollution that comes from non-CO2, non-greenhouse gas pollution that comes from burning fossil fuels as a result of these regulations?
Yeah, those are ancillary benefits that you would get. When, for example, when a coal plant, if it is emitting less CO2 by its nature, it's also going to be emitting less NOx, less SO2, a variety of particulates. So there are a lot of health benefits associated with reducing some of the greenhouse gas emissions that these facilities are putting into the atmosphere.
And let me just add, the oil and gas companies have complained that there aren't going to be out-of-state offsets available under our proposal, but the fact that we're restricting it to in-state offsets means that we get all those ancillary benefits, those local benefits of reduction in other pollutants.
And I guess that you're not allowing out-of-state offsets because how would you enforce it?
Well, that's certainly one of the big issues with out-of-state offsets. Now, there are some registries out there that do certify out-of-state offsets and certify international offsets. But as far as NMAD and its ability to go out-of-state or out of its jurisdiction and assure that those offsets are valid, yeah, there is some limitation there. The other thing is what Bruce mentioned as well. Those offsets can provide not only health benefits to New Mexico, but also economic benefits. If you're, for example, reducing biogas emissions, reducing methane emissions at landfills, those are all, that's business activity and economic activity in the state. So to the extent we're regulating these sources in the state, we want to keep that economic activity that it's driving in the state as well, so that there can be an economic benefit associated with these regulations.
We're talking to Steve Michael from Western Resource Advocates and Bruce Frederick with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Let's talk about that for a moment. How would this kind of regulation, which, of course, when there's ever any regulation, you have industry crying out that it will have economically adverse consequences. How could it have economically positive consequences for New Mexico?
Well, first, let me talk a little bit about what industry is proclaiming to be the negative economic impact of these regulations. And one of the features of these regulations that I think is important for people to understand is that unlike a lot of cap-and-trade mechanisms where polluters are required to pay for every ton of CO2 that they emit, these regulations approach it from a different perspective. They say, okay, polluters, we're not going to make you pay for all the tons you emit, but we're going to make you pay to reduce your emissions. So instead of, let's say you've got a source that's emitting 100,000 tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, instead of making that, and you want to reduce that by 3,000 tons, by 3%, instead of making them pay a fee for every ton they're emitting, which is 97,000 tons, we're making them pay to reduce just the 3,000 tons. And the economic difference between those two approaches is huge. And the neat thing about it is you get exactly the same carbon reduction in either approach. It's just that when you're approaching it from a reduction standpoint instead of an allowance standpoint, you're creating a much lower economic impact than you would through some of the other programs that have been floated either federally or locally.
What if they just don't do it? Are there punitive measures, or what happens?
These regulations are being adopted in part under the Air Quality Control Act, state law, and there's penalties for noncompliance with that act. Also, there may be something like injunctive relief.
What does that mean?
Injunctive relief means a court would order them to comply with the regulations, and if there was failure to comply, then they could be held in contempt, which could involve either money penalties or incarceration.
Yeah, Mary, if I can, I just wanted to follow up a little bit more on this economic impact, because I think it's very important for your listeners to understand that there is an economic cap in this regulation. We don't think that cap's going to be met because it's set very high. It's set at $50 a ton. What that means is if a source spends $50 per ton to reduce their emissions and they can't get there, they can stop. They're considered compliant. Like I said, carbon reduction should not cost anywhere near $50, at least in the early years. But what that cap does is it provides some certainty as to what the maximum economic impact is going to be. And what's so critical here is to understand that for the electric utilities and the price of electricity that customers see, this is going to increase their bills less than 1% per year. I mean, and, you know, when you look at the amount that electric bills have been going up in the state over the last few years, this is nothing. In the oil and gas sector, you've got an industry whose price of gas, price of oil, probably fluctuates 100% or more within a matter of months or can. These regulations are going to affect the commodity price, the end price of those products, by less than 1% a year. And so I think that's very important to understand, that the economic cost of this regulation, not considering all the benefits, is going to be very, very small.
And of course, always keeping in mind, and we will be talking about this more later this week, that the cost of not doing anything in the long run is very, very high.
And that's the whole point of this, is we need to get started. This is a huge problem out there that no one's addressing, and we need to address it. And New Mexico should not be waiting for the region, for the nation, for the world to act. Everybody needs to move forward as fast as they can and as much as they can if we've got a chance of dealing with this issue.
What if new, for example, new power plants, new utilities are built? How do they, I mean, they can't reduce because they didn't exist in 2010. What happens then?
What the regulations propose are benchmarks for new sources. We don't want to penalize new sources and tell them that they can't emit any greenhouse gases. So what it does is it sets a benchmark that they can either beat or not beat. If they beat it, they get credits that they can use at other operations that also need to comply. But what happens, and this is part of the reason for the reassessment in 2014, is to see how much of our emission reductions are actually being offset by new source emissions, and can we adjust? And what we would have to do is adjust our reduction goals to make sure that it does account for growth or for the emissions caused by new sources.
And let me just add, if a new source comes in, it doesn't have to meet that benchmark just with emissions and reduction controls at the source. They can come in with offsets as well to meet their obligation. Because, and the reason for this is, of course, is that global warming's a global phenomenon, and these are long-lived gases. They're well mixed in the atmosphere, and they stay up there for decades sometimes. So it doesn't matter whether the reduction occurs at the source or someplace else, as long as we're reducing levels.
Now, one of the things that this regulation, this proposed regulation says, is that if there is federal law that comes in that is passed to regulate greenhouse gases, then the New Mexico law would no longer be necessary or applicable. What if the federal law were considerably weaker than New Mexico's law?
It would still, this regulation would still sunset. You know, as Bruce mentioned, this is a global issue. You know, frankly speaking, the emission reductions that New Mexico achieves are going to make very little difference in what happens to the issue of global warming in and of themselves. What we're hoping with this regulation is that we can show other jurisdictions you can act, you can go forward, and if enough jurisdictions do act, that it will make a difference. But at the end of the day, this is a problem that needs to be solved at the federal level and the international level. And once the feds step in and do something, that's going to have a lot more impact than anything that New Mexico can do on its own.
And it's important to point out, the opposition always says that, you know, we admit that New Mexico acting alone won't solve the problem of global warming. And that's true, but they're assuming no other jurisdiction is going to act. I think we can be a model for other states to act. If you compare our proposal with other proposals, you'll see that ours is 5 or 6 pages long, and theirs are often thousands of pages long or hundreds of pages long. Ours is vastly simpler. If we can get ours off the ground, then there is a real good chance that the same thing could be implemented quite simply in other states by other state legislatures and regulatory boards.
What have your conversations with the various industries, fossil fuel burning industries, been like? In other words, are they all just monolithically opposed to any regulation whatsoever? Do they see that climate change is a problem and want to help in some way? Are they branching out into solar and wind? What's going on?
It depends on who you're talking to. Some of the industry folks do recognize climate change is a problem. They just don't think New Mexico should be moving out in front of the issue. They think we should wait until there's federal action, whenever they may be. Other industry folks, you know, range from, no, we don't have to do anything, to, there's not even a problem here that we need to address. So it really does depend.
Yeah, the way I divide it out is the utilities generally, in fact, across the board, seem to have no problem with climate change or climate science. They totally believe it's happening, I think in part because it's built into their rate structure. You know, it has to be accounted for in their rates somehow, and Steve probably knows more about that than I do. The oil and gas industry in general, they did provide a witness that that tried to counter climate science and the fact of global warming very ineffectively, but since it's not built into their rates and they have nothing to gain, they're against it.
You know, one of the things that we saw in some of the testimony that was filed in the case was claims, you know, particularly that up in the Four Corners area, that this is going to create a death spiral, you know, and the industry is just going to pack up and leave the state. And in fact, if you read most of the folks that have looked at this and looked at the options for reducing greenhouse gases, one of the biggest short-term opportunities is using natural gas instead of coal. And so most economists feel that natural gas is really going to see a boom time associated with climate change regulation, which is going to be very beneficial to the Four Corners region and other parts of the state.
Except that there's so many people who are against drilling because hydraulic fracturing is toxic to their water supply, or they feel that it is, or there are studies that have shown that
That's very much an issue that needs to be grappled with. That's right. We don't know what's in those chemicals that they're using to fracture those seams.
So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is really a group of some of the most distinguished scientists in the world who have been working on this in, I think you could say, a sound and probably somewhat conservative manner, have come up with the numbers that we need to be 25% below 1990 levels of greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, we're way above 1990 levels already. By the year 2020, that's 10 years from now, and 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. First of all, do our regulations that you are testifying on behalf of next week, are they pretty much in accordance with those kinds of what seemingly quite drastic numbers?
To the extent we know what those numbers in 1990 were, they are. And one thing to keep in mind is you had mentioned that we're far, far, you know, emitting a whole lot more than we were in 1990. That may not actually be the case. We know that from the year 2000 until 2008, our emissions actually dropped a little bit in the state.
In New Mexico.
And probably elsewhere as well. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Part of it may be the recession. Part of it has to do with the fact that there's a lot more renewable energy. A lot of states have renewable energy standards that are requiring utilities to serve a pretty substantial percent of their energy with renewable resources. So there are a lot of things going on that have helped us manage it over at least the last 8 years. Now, what happened between 1990 and 2000, it's sort of hard to say. There is some information out there, but we're not real sure exactly what those levels were in 1990. So the best that we can do, we have crafted this regulation to put us on track to achieve what we think would result in that level of emission reductions by those dates.
And when you look at the bigger picture, I mean, you know, by the year 2050, when most of us who are listening to this probably won't even be on the, well, maybe our younger people will, but most of us won't even be around, but 80% below 1990 levels, what kind of big picture energy production world do you envision?
What I see is our energy needs being served almost entirely with renewables. I mean, basically what that means is you look at what's serving us today, what resources and what energy resources are serving us today, subtract 80% of that, and assume that all the growth between now and 2050 is served with zero carbon emitting resources. You're right. That's a change to our economy. It's a major restructuring.
And it's a change to our infrastructure,
it's
above all.
It's a change to everything. And what I see happening is most of our needs will be served with renewables, hopefully renewables like solar, wind. There may be some nuclear, maybe not. It's sort of, you know, I don't know. But the role of fossil fuels will be very limited in the long term. You know, it will be mostly gas, and it will mostly be used for firming up intermittent renewable resources. And what that means is, at the times that renewable resources aren't available because of cloud cover, whatever, those gas resources could be deployed to make sure that the energy is still going to customers.
If people are concerned about this issue, they want their voices to be heard about climate change and this regulation in particular, what should they do?
The most direct thing they can do is show up at the hearing, which will begin on August 16th and run through the entire week. If they can't do that, then they can email Joyce Medina at the State Environment Department and email their comments in supporting the rule, and that should and ask it to be accepted into the record. They should also get in touch with their gubernatorial candidates and tell them that this is an important issue and that New Mexico needs to act on it, and also talk to their legislators.
And talk to their congressional delegation in New Mexico. I think generally our delegation is pretty supportive of acting on climate change, but it never hurts to reinforce that.
And ladies and gentlemen, Joyce Medina's email is joyce.medina@state.nm.us.
She'll be thanking me for that.
Well, I hope people write enough emails that that she will be. Steve Michael is an attorney with the Western Resource Advocates, and Bruce Frederick is an attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Thanks both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.